Chapter 6. Your emotions are messengers, not dictators. Close your eyes and imagine the happiest moment of your life. Perhaps it's the absolute joy of bringing a child into the world. Or maybe it was the day you stood across from your partner, overwhelmed by a transcendent feeling of love and connection as you vowed to cherish and support him or her for the rest of your life. Chances are, even recalling that happy moment brings back an assortment of feel-good emotions. We live for and treasure the moments that bring about love, happiness, and joy. They make life special, worth living. But what if you couldn't experience love or joy? What if you were numb to the sensations or unable to sort through what the butterflies meant while standing in front of the altar? In 2009, a man named Stephen, not me to be clear, married the love of his life. Like we would expect, he was smiling widely, a signal of the pure bliss of the moment he was having with his wife. The only problem, Stephen was faking it. Not for a nefarious reason. He truly enjoyed the company of his soon-to-be wife. He simply couldn't feel love or joy. He has alexithymia. In discussing his condition, Stephen told Mosaic, "From an inner feeling point of view, anything I do that requires an emotional response feels like a fake. Most of my responses are learned responses. In an environment where everyone is being jolly and happy, it feels like I'm lying, acting, which I am. So it is a lie." Alexithymia isn't technically a disorder. It's a catch-all term that literally means having no words for emotions. It's intended to capture those who struggle to describe and identify emotions. There's a wide variation of severity in those who experience alexithymia, ranging from individuals who feel nothing to those who experience some sort of sensation but have difficulty putting words to the experience. Stephen echoed this complexity in describing his condition. "I feel something, but I'm unable to distinguish in any real way what that feeling is." Not surprisingly, there are negative consequences for experiencing alexithymia. It's associated with PTSD in soldiers and suicidal thinking in the general population. In the case of alexithymia, it's not just that one's inner body is speaking a different language. It's that the language is in a form we can't even begin to understand. It's like seeing hieroglyphics for the first time without the Rosetta Stone. One's inner world is gibberish. While alexithymia represents the extreme scenario, we all vary in our ability to read, distinguish, and understand our emotions. It's a skill. Our feelings and emotions provide an overview of the homeostatic function of the entire body, a status update of sorts. Emotions help to alert, advise, and regulate. Yet, in the old model of toughness, we're told that emotions should be ignored or suppressed. We shun instead of embrace what we feel. The old model falls short. In order to navigate discomfort, we need to listen to the messages our body is sending. The power of what we feel. Feelings and emotions are close cousins, and we often use the two interchangeably. It's easy to get lost in the weeds of the difference between jittery and fear, or unpleasant and disgust. When it comes to toughness, a simple distinction can be made. Feelings are messengers that nudge. They are our bodies saying, something is different, before sending us on a quest to figure out why we feel a certain way. Emotions, on the other hand, are more complex. They require context and meaning. To go from simple displeasure to sadness, we need to know what sadness entails. We combine a raw sensation, pleasure, with what else is going on in our internal and external world, add in a dash of experience, and all of a sudden, we feel our version of the emotion love. If feelings are meant to inform and nudge, emotions are the alarm bells, screaming at you that something changed and that you need to do something about it. Emotions move us from nudge to shove. When it comes to toughness, feelings and emotions serve a vital role. Whenever we encounter scenarios where we need to be tough or make difficult decisions, our feelings and emotions set the stage. they bias us toward a particular response, but they don't control us. As writer Robert Wright wrote in the book, Why Buddhism is True, what emotions do, what emotions are for, is to activate and coordinate the modular functions that are, in Darwinian terms, appropriate for the moment. In other words, they are the first step in a cascade designed to prepare us for action. Imagine you're walking down a dark alley in an unfamiliar city. There's a tinge of unease. The hairs on the back of your neck stand up, and tension rises in your shoulders. You aren't aware of any signs of danger, but your body is on high alert, as if a mugger is hiding around the next dimly lit corner. Where do these sensations come from? Would you experience the same feelings if it were daytime, or if you were walking through an alleyway in your own neighborhood? To understand where feelings and sensations come from, we need to take a peek into how our brain processes sensory data. Our eyes take in the scenery, noting movement in the shadows, a pothole in the sidewalk. Our nose catches the smells and scents in the air. Our ears pick up the rustling of the grass. Our skin might feel leaves brush against it or the wind traverse across it. Internally, a racing heartbeat, an increase in our body temperature, or even a change in our muscles' acidity provides information that our brain must interpret and understand. Nerve fibers run throughout our body, transmitting information on changes in mechanical, chemical, metabolic, thermal, hypoxic, and hormonal states of just about every muscle, joint, and organ available. In other words, we contain a surveillance system on steroids, like a department store with a sensor attached to every rack of clothing, electric outlet, air conditioner, and piece of equipment in the store, all relaying whenever an item is touched, brushed, moved, or is simply not doing what is expected of it, all feeding back to some master control algorithm that decides whether to alert the security guard, sound the alarm, or let it be. In the body, this sensory network has a name, interoception, and a location, the brain, stretching from the cerebral cortex to the anterior cingulate cortex, ACC, and prefrontal cortex, PFC, and down into the insula. The interoceptive system provides an overview of the homeostatic function of the entire body, a type of status update on how your body is doing. Is your temperature normal? Are your glucose levels too high? The interoceptive system is active in a wide range of sensations, including thirst, touch, itch, sexual arousal, warmth, heartbeat, and even the sensory experience related to wine tasting. Your interoceptive system helps to alert, advise, and regulate. It's like the instrument panel that an airplane pilot has at her disposal, buzzing, beeping, and displaying. Only our body doesn't have a digital display, a way to communicate the data of our internal status to our conscious self. Instead, it uses an ingenious method, feelings and sensations. In 1896, Wilhelm Wundt, the first person to call himself a psychologist, developed the idea of affective primacy. His theory rested on the idea that small sensations and feelings reached conscious awareness before any other cue. As he stated, it is the affective elements which, as soon as they are strong enough, first become noticeable. They begin to force themselves energetically into the fixation point of consciousness before anything is perceived. Wundt believed that these nearly instant sensations of either pleasure or displeasure guided our actions, pushing us toward either approaching or avoiding whatever triggered the reaction. Wundt's ideas were put on the shelf for nearly 100 years until modern science caught up. In his book, The Strange Order of Things, neuroscientist Antonio Damasio summarizes our current understanding. Emotions and feelings provide us with a moment-to-moment perspective on the state of our health. When we experience a condition that is conducive to the continuation of life, we describe it in positive terms and call it pleasant. Feelings, be they excitement, fatigue, or unease, represent a summary of our interoceptive system, a signal that something is different and that we should pay attention to it. The function of feelings isn't merely about updating our condition, but to do just what Wundt hypothesized, to drive and direct us toward a possible solution. to approach or avoid something. To eat a piece of fruit, pleasant, or spit it out, bitter, unpleasant. Feelings nudge us toward evaluating whether a signal means danger or we should ignore it and move on. If we listen, our feelings inform and guide us. Feelings are predictive, not reactive. Have you ever felt like your phone was vibrating in your pocket, only to swipe at the screen and see no new emails, notifications, or calls? Don't worry, it's not just you. Over 70% of students had experienced this phantom vibration syndrome, according to a recent study. Those students experienced a prediction malfunction. Their brain was scanning the environment and created a sensation. We put so much emphasis on the rectangular box in our pocket that we've trained our minds to be on constant high alert, awaiting our next buzz or beep. It's not a coincidence that the more dependent you are on your phone, the more you experience phantom vibrations. Feelings aren't merely reactive, informing us of what's going on, but they are also predictive, informing us of what's to come. According to the latest scientific theory, our brain predicts the feedback that it will receive. In our alarm in a store analogy, think of it not only as having a sensor watching for feedback, but as someone who guesses which room or glass case is most likely to be in danger at any time. Sometimes, it even flips the alarm before anything has been stolen, anticipating a thief's move. Our brain works in a predictive manner, anticipating what sensory feedback will occur well before our muscles, heart, or skin sends the actual information back to us. Here's why listening to our emotions is essential to true toughness. They are telling us important information. Our feelings and emotions aren't merely the fuel gauge in our car, but more like the little indicator that tells you about how many miles you have left to drive before the tank is empty. Our bodies are taking in sensory information and making the best guess on what it should keep us informed about. Researchers theorize that feelings and sensations hint at how taxing something we are about to encounter is going to be on the body. How much gas will be drained from our tanks? Feel anxious while waiting to step onto the stage for a performance? That's our body telling us how far out of our norm we are about to push some of our systems. Or put another way, it's an indicator of the resources we will need to call upon shortly. No different than the feeling of unease or tension as we walk down an unfamiliar alleyway. Our brain is making a bet that it's better to be safe than sorry. So feelings that trigger potential danger pop up into our conscious awareness, sounding the alarm that we better be ready to run away, even if it might be wrong. When we ignore our feelings in the name of bulldozing through a hurdle and calling it being tough, we risk not understanding our needs and even our capabilities. We're losing valuable information that could help us make better decisions. Ignoring what we feel is akin to destroying the indicators on our dashboard. No need to know when oil or gas is running low. We'll just guess. Imagine standing on a wooden suspension bridge, wide enough for a person to squeeze by. With every step, the bridge sways left and then right. You look down and see the trees and river bottom over 200 feet below. As you peer down, the bridge wobbles beneath your feet, your heart rate jumps, adrenaline starts flowing through your body, and a feeling of excitement or unease washes over you. As you are making your way across the bridge, someone you find attractive approaches. They ask you to fill out a short survey about your experience. As you hand back the completed questionnaire, they write their phone number on the corner of the paper, tear it off, and invite you to give them a call if you want to talk further. In 1974, psychologists Arthur Aaron and Donald Dutton performed this experiment at the Capilano Suspension Bridge in Vancouver, Canada. They weren't assessing fear of heights. Instead, they were evaluating the level of attraction to the man or woman giving the survey. Upon completing the study, half of the male participants called the number their female surveyor left. When they ran the same experiment on a sturdy bridge, standing only 10 feet above the ditch below, a bridge that would trigger fear in just about no one, only 12.5% of males made a follow-up call. The discrepancy wasn't caused by any difference in gumption or confidence. It was what researchers call a misattribution of arousal. The men had confused the arousal caused by standing on a shaky bridge with a different kind of arousal, one triggered by the attractive female who had stopped them. The soaring heart rate and dash of anxiety caused by walking over a high, swaying bridge were, incorrectly, assigned to the beautiful woman standing in front of them. Their brain made a quick calculation that said, "Hey, our adrenaline is going, our heart rate increased, we feel arousal, and there's a woman standing in front of us. We must be attracted to her. Forget the danger of the bridge. It must be the woman." The men misattributed where the feelings of arousal were coming from. And this phenomenon doesn't just occur when performing acts that might leave us nervous or scared. Research shows that even just exercising, that is, increased heart rate and nervous system activation, can lead to the same mistake. Returning to our pilot's flight instrument panel analogy, when it comes to feelings, it's as if our panel doesn't have labels stating what the gauges are for: left fuel tank, right fuel tank, altitude, and temperature. We just have the sensations. We have to fill in their meaning with context. Should we feel afraid or excited? Are we under threat of falling off, or are we having a pretty safe but fun time, like when riding a roller coaster? When it came to Aaron and Dutton's experiment, the male subjects got the context all wrong. They didn't suffer from alexithymia, but it was as if they heard the word literally and interpreted it as being figurative. Feelings may serve the role of informing or nudging us toward a behavior, but they are also subject to distortion. The better we understand the interoceptive signals reaching our awareness, the better our interpretation and ultimately the decisions that come from them will be. In two studies out of Europe, a group of psychologists found that individuals who were clear about their feelings, understanding where they came from and what they meant, were more likely to thrive under stress, anxiety, and pressure. They turned anxiety into excitement and pressure into information and motivation, all thanks to clarity on the message their body was sending. Feelings serve as our first line of defense. They aren't something that the manliest among us should ignore. They provide vital information. Feelings help us make better decisions. Neuroscientist Antonio Damasio and colleagues set out to investigate the role of emotions in decision-making by studying patients who couldn't experience emotions in the same way that you or I would. They found patients who had damage to their ventromedial prefrontal cortex, VMPFC, an area critical for emotional processing. In a series of studies, the patients were put through a barrage of images and stories designed to evoke an emotional reaction. Pictures that generally bring about joy or disgust caused nearly zero reaction. When faced with stories of moral dilemmas, such as whether murder was permissible, the patients with damaged VMPFCs often chose the opposite of the control group. When presented with situations that required evaluating potential harm, they were poor decision makers. They lacked that slight sensation of disgust or displeasure, which guides our decisions not only on what is right and wrong, but in our everyday life. In his book, Descartes' Error, Damasio outlines how the lab results translated to the real world. The individuals were incredibly poor at making decisions in their day-to-day activities. The patients' lives were often ruined by bad decisions that impacted their familial and work life. When it comes to making decisions, feelings and emotions aren't bad. They are necessary. The research is clear. The Junction Boys model of toughness that teaches us to ignore or suppress what we feel goes against how our brain and body actually work. The power through mantra makes sense only if you actually take stock of what you are powering through. That is what the old definition of grit got wrong. Feelings are signals that need to be understood. Pain isn't something to fear or push our way through. It's a message that needs interpretation, one that sometimes needs heeding and other times can be allowed to pass by. And if we mistake a challenge for danger or nerves for a full-blown anxiety attack, it doesn't matter how tough we are headed straight toward a freakout. The first step to toughness is training your body and mind to understand and interpret the signals you are receiving. Toughness maxim. Feelings are subject to distortion. They depend on context and interpretation. The better we're able to interpret, the better our ultimate decision. To feel is to decide. By all parameters, the movie Titanic was a cultural phenomenon. The James Cameron-directed film netted over $2 billion at the box office and accumulated 14 Oscar nominations with 11 victories. Critics and fans alike were blown away by Cameron's masterpiece. But two decades later, controversy still surrounds one decision Cameron made. In the climactic scene, our heroes, Rose and Jack, are floundering about in the freezing water after the ship went down. They come across a piece of debris, a door, floating in the ocean. Rose and Jack take one quick attempt at both climbing upon the floating door before falling off. After the singular attempt, Jack makes the noble decision to step aside and put Rose's life first, helping her climb aboard and compelling her to stay on while he wades in the water beside her. Jack sacrifices himself, perishing in the freezing water to save the woman he loves. The ultimate selfless act. I think he could have actually fit on that bit of door, Kate Winslet, the actress who played Rose in the film, told Jimmy Kimmel in 2016. Winslet was referring to what has become known as Doorgate, the rabid internet-driven debate over whether Jack could have survived by climbing alongside Rose. Internet sleuths have spent countless hours trying to solve this dilemma, mapping out the area of the door and calculating its buoyancy. Even Cameron inserted himself into the fray, stating, "The answer is very simple, because it says on page 147 of the script that Jack dies." We can all agree that Jack's actions were noble and possibly heroic. Cameron needed Jack to make the sacrifice, so in the movie world, Jack needed to die. But what if the situation was different? What if, instead of Jack choosing to sacrifice himself, Rose commanded, "No, Jack, get off the door. I need to live." Would that change how you viewed the scene? What if, instead of sacrifice, both Rose and Jack repeatedly tried to find a way to float on the door together? But after several attempts, Jack realized that both of them would die if they tried to stay afloat together, so he pushed Rose into the water. How does that make you feel about Jack? Or what if our two heroes had been on a door with a stranger, the three of them floating in the freezing sea, but they quickly realized that although three of them were on the door right now, the door simply couldn't stay afloat, so they pushed the stranger off so that they could survive? What if instead of a stranger, it was the film's villain, the arrogant Cal Hockley, the abusive man Rose escaped? With each twist of the scenario, you might have noticed a different feeling or sensation. Having Jack and Rose push a bystander off the door to save themselves might bring about a bit of disgust and alter how you see our heroes. When the bystander shifted to the movie's villain, instead of disgust, you might have felt vindication. Despite performing the same selfish action, it now feels justified. When a research team out of the University of Pennsylvania looked at similar scenarios where violence was either justified, such as the killing of an abusive partner, or not in a movie scene, not only did participants feel different, but their brains also reacted differently. When participants saw justified violence, an area in the brain related to moral evaluation lit up, indicating that the viewer saw the violence as acceptable. Philosophers and psychologists have utilized such scenarios for decades to evaluate how people grapple with complicated moral decisions. How do we know what is right or wrong? These scenarios are often referred to as trolley problems, where the ultimate end is the same in all scenarios, that is, someone dies, but the context on how they get to that point changes. The classic trolley problem involves an individual standing at a train track with a train barreling down on five individuals. The individual is presented with a choice. He can flip a switch and divert the train to an alternate track with only one person standing on it, or he can do nothing. So instead of killing five individuals, only one dies. In an alternate scenario, instead of flipping a switch to divert the train, our decision maker has to push one individual in front of the train to save the five. Does that change whether or not we would follow through with the action and our views on whether it was moral or not? In 2001, Harvard psychologist Joshua Green presented subjects with several variations of the trolley problem while scanning their brains with an fMRI machine. Half of the stories presented contained scenarios where the subject had to harm someone else in order to save the others, that is, push someone in front of the trolley. The other stories focused on impersonal harm, such as flipping a switch. The former stories tended to elicit a feeling of disgust or displeasure, while the latter did not. When you make it impersonal, the visceral reaction goes down. And when Green and colleagues looked at the fMRI scans, when subjects read a personal harm story, the areas in the brain related to emotional processing lit up. This flicker of feeling and emotional processing was also tied to the decision each subject made about the scenario's morality. The strength of the feeling predicted the decision. In his book, The Righteous Mind, Jonathan Haidt outlines the evolution of moral reasoning since the work of Green. While we might like to think that logic leads to whether we judge something as moral or not, Haidt believes feelings, not reason, play a vital role. In his book, Haidt concluded, "When we're trying to decide what we think about something, we look inward at how we're feeling. If I'm feeling good, I must like it. And if I'm feeling anything unpleasant, that must mean I don't like it." And while we've focused on moral judgments, feelings play the same role in just about any decision we make. Feelings like disgust send a message, telling us whether something is good or bad for us. Feelings don't just communicate, they nudge us toward a behavior, push us toward action. They help us decide what path to choose. Accompanying any difficult situation is a cacophony of feelings and emotions. Understanding their role as messengers and pushers allows you to find clarity instead of being overwhelmed with confusion. Feelings give you a clue to what your body is predicting. A touch of anxiety signals that you may be a bit wary of what's to come, but you're fully equipped to take it on. A sense of dread, and you know your body is preparing for the worst, ready to hit the eject button, and you might need to try a different coping strategy to make your way to the other side of the challenge. Feelings provide clues to where your body is hedging its bet. And the beautiful thing is the more clarity you have, the easier it is to choose whether you go along with that decision or chart a new course. Toughness maxim. Feelings send a message, conveying information and nudging us toward a behavior. Appraisal. Reading the signals. According to a 2015 analysis, nearly 17% of teenagers have cut themselves or enacted some form of self-harm. For the most part, people cut themselves not to cause severe, lasting damage, but as a way to cope. To deal with the rigors of life, cutting oneself offers a feeling unrelated to whatever issues a person is dealing with. A trading of one sensation, emotional pain, for another, physical pain. In a series of studies out of Swansea University, psychologists offered an additional explanation for why people self-harm. Instead of focusing on the coping element of self-harm, they investigated the sensations and emotions that trigger the behavior. Haley Young and colleagues hypothesized that individual differences in interoceptive ability, or the capacity to process and conceptualize the various signals our body sends to our mind, were at play. Their initial study found a connection between those who self-harmed and how they self-rated their interoceptive abilities. The self-harm group had greater interoceptive ambivalence and lower interoceptive appreciation. Once that link was established, they took it a step further. They had subjects sit quietly and count their heartbeats. The catch? They couldn't put their finger on their pulse or use any other simple solution. This test of our interoceptive abilities forces us to dial in on our most basic internal feedback, our heart beating. The more accurate we are at guessing our heart rate, the better our ability to read the internal status of our body. When Young and colleagues compared those who had a history of self-harm to a control group, the self-harm subjects were more aware of their feelings and sensations, but they performed worse on the interoceptive task. They felt more, but couldn't distinguish or interpret what those signals meant. As the authors concluded, self-harm may serve to resolve the resulting state of emotional and interoceptive uncertainty associated with the body's function in emotional experience. In some ways, this is a close cousin to the individuals who were fooled by their feelings while standing on a bridge. One was a misattribution of a feeling, the other an inability to process or understand those feelings. If we aren't able to accurately read the signals that our body and mind are putting forward, then to cope with them, we choose the easiest route: ignore or eliminate the sensation. In extreme cases, that might mean self-harm. Impaired interoceptive awareness has been found in everything from addiction to eating disorders. When we aren't able to make sense of our internal world, we turn to external ways to cope. The same holds true for other feelings and sensations. Kindergartners who don't understand the shame or angst of getting in trouble for the first time resort to tantrums. Or the person who, after a frustrating day at work, takes their anger out on their partner. When we don't have clarity in our internal world, we tend to resort to less effective coping mechanisms. An ability to read and discern our inner world gives us the flexibility to respond in a more productive manner. If you've ever gone to the gym after having not worked out in a while, you're well aware of the difficulty in reading interoceptive feedback. Maybe your machismo gets the best of you and harkens you back to your college days, performing a workout that 20-year-old John or Jill could handle, but certainly not the 40-year-old version. The next day, you wake up with pain and stiffness screaming from your muscles and joints. Barely able to lift yourself out of bed and hobble to the door, you wonder whether this is some form of extreme soreness or a catastrophic injury. Do you need to walk it off or head to your orthopedic doctor right away? This soreness versus injury conundrum isn't reserved for those of us trying to relive our glory days. It's a vital component of learning for any young athlete. In athletics, we call this knowing what you can train through and what you can't. An expert at interoception is no different than the veteran pilot who needs to merely glance at a gauge instead of reading the label or manual. An experienced athlete can separate pain and injury. A stage performer can distinguish between nervousness and anxiety. An executive understands when her gut is pushing her in the right direction and when she should ignore it. Our ability to make sense of the simple sensations and the complex emotions leads to better decision-making and ultimately toughness. Situations that require toughness are those that involve a high level of stress, pressure, or adversity. Such conditions are prime for misreading and misattributing our feelings and emotions. It's easy to mistake a body brimming with adrenaline and excitement for one that's full of anxiety and unease. Research shows that tougher athletes are better able to make sense of whatever feedback their body is giving them. A study out of the University of California, San Diego, found that individuals who scored lower on resilience had lower interoceptive awareness when put under stress. And in an intriguing study out of the UK, psychologists found that stock traders who had better interoception not only were more profitable, but also lasted longer in a business that is notorious for turnover. It wasn't the traders with the better credentials who excelled at making risky decisions. It was the ones who could read their body. When I presented this research to my friend Marcel, who works in a similar field that relies on assessing and making risky decisions, investment banking, he replied, "Pedigree gets you in the door. Thoughtfulness and self-awareness are what separate you." If we continually misread the signals that our body is sending, our brain's predictions on what's coming will also be flawed. Researchers who studied elite athletes and military special forces reported that the decreased awareness and responsiveness of interoceptive signals leaves low-resilience individuals unprepared in the face of interoceptive perturbation. Low-resilience individuals may be unable to make accurate body prediction errors, as their reduced interoceptive monitoring may lead to poor integration of current body states to predict future body states. In simpler terms, bad data in means a bad prediction out. When we lose the capacity to distinguish the nuance of the experience, we jump straight to the easy decision. Part of being tough is fine-tuning your ability to experience and decipher what you're feeling. Better interoceptive skills are correlated with better emotional functioning and linked to lower levels of depression. Those who suffer from depression aren't able to read their body as well as those who don't, much the same way that amateur athletes can't discern between normal pain and a potentially debilitating injury. Tough individuals develop the ability to discern the nuance that most of us are blind to. Thankfully, this is a skill that can be developed. As we've seen in this chapter, discerning nuance involves two components. 1. Awareness of feelings and sensations. 2. Interpretation and contextualization of feelings and emotions. The first step toward developing nuance involves going deep into the experience. If we direct our attention toward an emotion or sensation, examining the feedback for long enough, we can start to distinguish shades of gray where there was once a single category. Go toward the discomfort, deliberately focusing your attention so that you can peel back the layers. Another strategy that allows us to understand the nuance of signals and sever the bond they have with actions is to label them. We can interpret very similar sensations, increased heart rate, sweaty palms, a touch of jitters, in drastically different ways, from nervousness to excitement. When we label emotions or experiences, we can change not only our interpretation of them, but also how our body responds. When researchers out of UCLA had participants label what they were feeling before giving a speech, they dampened down their brain's alarm, amygdala, and turned on the brain's controller, PFC. The more granular their descriptions, the better they were able to handle the swirl of emotions that accompanied the public speaking. Clinical psychologists employ this same concept by utilizing items such as the emotion wheel, a graphic that lists common feelings, such as angry, and pushes us to consider more granular versions, like resentful, indignant, furious, jealous, or withdrawn. How we describe and label what we feel impacts our subsequent performance. When we name something, we take back control, converting the ambiguous to something tangible that we can understand, manipulate, and come to terms with. Even how we talk about feelings and emotions matters. Take the example of depression. It's common to say, "I'm sad," but that doesn't make sense when you think about it. That implies that sadness is concrete, a trait that you can't change. If instead you say, "I'm experiencing a wave of sadness," it implies that it's a trait that will pass. It might seem trivial, but the language we use to describe what we are experiencing goes a long way in determining whether we have power over our emotions or they control us. If we can develop the ability to discern what sensations and emotions are telling us, it not only weakens their connection to the cascade of negative thoughts or actions, but it also allows us to interpret them more accurately and to understand that some feelings are meaningless or unimportant, false alarms triggered by an overactive inner self, something to let float away that reminds us that a feeling is nothing more than a piece of information. The better we understand the signals coming from our body, the better decisions we can make. Toughness maxim. Poor interoception leads to poor predictions, which leads to lower toughness and worse decision-making. Developing nuance exercises. Exercise 1. Go deep to understand nuance. 1. Get specific. In this exercise, you want to experience feelings that are closely related to the situation you are working on. For example, for the pain of an athletic competition, hop on an exercise bike and do a hard workout, or sit in an ice bath and feel a similar kind of pain. For anxiety, if it's social, put yourself in an uncomfortable social situation. Or stand on the balcony at a hotel if heights give you that same feeling. Always make sure you are taking safety into account. 2. Go into the feelings and sensations. Direct your attention right at what you're experiencing or feeling and sit with that sensation. The goal is to experience without judging. Our aim is to collect experiences, not necessarily to do anything about them, just to begin the process of unraveling what pain or anxiety means in different contexts. Exercise 2. Name it. 1. Develop a vocabulary. When a first grader is asked to describe a person, they stick with basic adjectives: pretty, smart, nice. As they expand their vocabulary, they can describe people and objects more effectively. When it comes to emotions and feelings, most of us act like kindergartners. Expanding our vocabulary allows us to find nuance and clarity. 2. Describe the feeling. When describing what you're feeling, get creative and try to describe it in as many ways as possible. For example, pain is nebulous. Is it burning, dull, transient, or constant? The same goes for stress or anxiety. Use tools like the emotion wheel, or search for synonyms that may better describe the experience. When describing our inner experience, first go for breadth, then depth. 3. Separate the feeling from the physiology. While describing, try to separate the physical sensations from the feeling. For example, sweaty palms and a racing heart are the physical sensations. The anxiety or fear that we often intertwine is separate. 4. Name it. Emotions develop based on context. Find the nuance between the different signals. The nerves you feel before giving a talk? Call that your performance adrenaline. When we name something, we exert power and control over it. We are saying, "I know what you are and how to handle you." 5. Reappraise it. Reframe the signal as helpful information. Can you see anxiety, fear, pain, and sadness as signals conveying a message? Now that you understand the nuance of feelings and emotions and have a name for what you're experiencing, take control of the message. Can you see anxiety as excitement? The fear you experience is a reminder that caution has value. The sadness after a loss is a reminder to cherish and reconnect with those you still have with you. Reframing emotions and feelings as information that you can choose to listen to or simply let float on by is a powerful tool for navigating our messy inner world. Messenger or dictator. When it comes to feelings, we tend to focus on the final step, the regulation of them. Do we ignore them or give in to them? Males are often taught from a young age to ignore or block out what we feel, while females are derided for being too emotional. Both sexes are sent a similar message, that feelings and emotions are something to be suppressed, except for in particular situations. We are taught to follow our passion when it comes to choosing a job, or listen to our heart when it comes to finding love. We receive a contrasting message to listen to some emotions, but block out others. The focus is on what to do with them. Emotional regulation plays a role in decision-making and toughness, something we'll cover in Chapter 9, but it's the final step in a cascade. By the time we get to regulation, if the bond between what we feel and our subsequent behavioral response is too tight, no amount of willpower or strength can sever that connection. Like a child who jumps straight from being insulted to throwing a fit, if the bond is too tight, not much can be done. If we focus on the front end, interpreting and understanding our emotions, we have the potential to impact everything downstream, from where our attention goes, to our inner dialogue, to our behavioral response. We give ourselves a better shot at delaying the jump from feeling stressed to a full-blown freakout. The ability to read and understand our inner world determines whether we are at a loss, guessing what alarm is going off, or know what message our body is trying to send. If we know the message, choosing the correct solution becomes much easier. Toughness is about accurately reading these signals, knowing what your body is saying, and being able to decide whether or not to respond. It's not that we have to give in to every craving, every signal. Some might be wrong. Others, for example, the urge to eat sweets, may be a remnant from a past when calories were much harder to come by. Reading your feelings and emotions helps give you the ability to choose whether to give them attention, simply let them pass by, or utilize them for motivation. When testing how individuals work in high-pressure situations, researchers out of Spain found that people could use the anxiety that came along with pressure to their advantage. They could persist longer at a task, reach a higher level of achievement on an academic test, and even have greater job satisfaction. All thanks to the feeling of anxiety. What separated those that were able to use anxiety to their advantage? Whether or not they had clarity on what they were feeling. The researchers concluded, individuals who are clear about their feelings are more likely to thrive on anxiety. Even so-called negative feelings can be beneficial. It comes down to clarity of our inner world. The better we can read and distinguish the internal signals that our body is sending, the better we are able to use feelings and emotions as information to help guide our actions instead of missing the signal or moving straight from feeling to reacting. A systematic review found that the better our interoceptive abilities, the better we can handle stress. From elite athletes to military personnel to adventurers who experience extreme stress, researchers found that one of the keys to performing under such conditions was an ability to listen to and understand their internal state. They were able to match the feedback their emotions were giving with an appropriate response. Those who seemed to succumb to the perils of the situation struggled to read their internal signals. They were like a new athlete who can't distinguish between pain that will go away and pain that signals a likely injury. When we have clarity on what we're feeling, we can keep that signal as informational with a little nudge, versus an alarm bell that dictates and enforces. Uncertainty sounds the alarm. Clarity allows us to find the appropriate button to push. Are feelings and emotions messengers relaying information? Or are they dictators pushing us toward a reaction with little or no control over the outcome? Our goal is to keep them largely as messengers.